Hello friends, it me, Bethany Rutter. I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
It me, Alice Slater.
And we are, what page are you on? We are recording this back to back with the episode that came out last week, so we're not going to do our little chat about what we've been reading because
we have nothing further to say.
Literally the same day, so we have nothing to add.
Which is why we don't tend to record bulk episodes, because
we want to bring you fresh. We want to bring you new.
I didn't realise, though, in the last episode, I was intending to do, like, a holy shit, think of all the amazing literary goss we've missed while we've not been recording, such as Joyce Carol Oates setting fire to all her books.
Nope, different person.
No, who was
Jeanette
it?
Winterson.
Jeanette Winterson.
Joyce Carol Oates does other world shit, like posting that picture of her foot. That was a different thing.
Yeah. Anyway, I was just thinking, we forgot to do a little recap. But yeah, we have missed on a lot of good goss.
We should have done a We Didn't Start the Fire parody with all of the literary goss that has happened since we last recorded. But we didn't.
Anyway, so we're just going to do an ep, just going to record another one. We're doing like, we've alluded to this episode quite a few times without specifying what it is we're doing. But we're going to do, like, a deep dive into the phenomenon of, like, what I think of as super bestsellers.
Yes. Blockbusters.
Yeah. The perennial bestsellers, which remain selling steady years or decades after their release. And we have read one.
That is the sound of Alice slamming it down on the table.
We read one.
We read one. Well, she says we read one. Alice has read half of it.
I can't believe you're calling me out already for not finishing the assignment.
Well, she's read half of it.
It was six. Anyway, it's 600 pages long. We'll get to it. But first of all, we're just going to talk a little bit about bestsellers and like numbers and just all that kind of good data. Kicking things off. Bethany, how would you describe a bestseller?
I have no idea because I didn't really know what it took. Like, I have no concept for sales figures at all on this scale. Like, I don't really know what it takes to be the biggest selling book of the year in terms of numbers. I don't know what it then takes to become, you know, one of the biggest selling books of all time. Like, I don't know how many copies Harry Potter has sold, for example.
I do.
Tell me.
Okay, so Harry Potter as a collective series has broken 500 million copies.
That's a lot.
That's all seven books, though. Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone approximately has sold 120 million.
Okay.
The reason why I say approximately is because actually gathering this data is quite complicated. So we have this thing called Nielsen Book Scan. Nielsen track every book that is sold in the UK through a bookshop. I believe they also monitor online sales, but Amazon are very cagey about their ebook sales.
Mm-hmm.
So audio and ebooks are kind of a question mark. And then also it's difficult to aggregate some data because Nielsen has only been around since like 1998.
Okay.
So before that we were just relying on publisher information. So for example, the publisher of 50 Shades of Grey claim it's the best-selling book of all time, but it is not. I guess when we get to like numbers of this kind of scale as well, I think this is one of the reasons why I thought this would be an interesting episode, because I think a lot of us as casual readers have no idea what volume of sales is normal, what's abnormal, what's incredibly high, what's incredibly low. Like, we just don't really know. And I'm really interested in this kind of data. The best-selling individual books of all time. So this is not counting things like religious texts, because we can't possibly know, we can't track that. I think the longer a book has been around for, the more difficult it is to guesstimate how many copies exist. This is also not about the number of copies printed, and it's not about the number of copies owned. So free books, for example, like World Book Night, don't count because they haven't been sold. But the top five of all time... Oh, and one more thing that doesn't count. We don't actually have any accurate figures for the Lord of the Rings trilogy, because there have been so many editions that sell them as a trilogy. You can't separate them out.
Yeah.
So it's never included in the individual bestsellers. Whereas The Hobbit is actually the fourth best-selling fiction book of all time at 100 million copies. So yeah, the top five bestsellers of all time: Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone at 120 million. The Little Prince at 100 million. This is all approximate, obviously. Dream of the Red Chamber, which is an 18th century Chinese novel, at 100 million. The Hobbit, and then there were none by Agatha Christie, is in there at number 5, also with approximately 100 million.
That surprises me.
Right?
I'm already surprised.
Yeah, it's already surprising. Yeah. Tell me what surprises you most about that list. Is it the fact that you haven't heard of one of them?
No, I mean, China is so big that I'm not surprised that there is a Chinese book on this list. What surprises me is The Little Prince and Then There Were None. Those are the two things that surprise me.
Yeah, like if you were going to pick all-time bestsellers, would you go... I would never in 1,000 years have guessed The Little Prince.
No.
Like in 1,000 years.
I'd have guessed like other children's books before that.
So like give me an example and I can find where it is.
I guess something like... I mean, I wouldn't have put it... I wouldn't have even put... The Little Prince, you know, obviously this is more than 100 million copies. This is like the top of the top of the top.
This is the creme de la creme, yeah.
So, you know, I would have said that something like, I don't know, The Gruffalo had sold more copies than The Little Prince, but I wouldn't have ever said that The Gruffalo would be in the more than 100 million copies. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the difficult thing, isn't it? Like, let me see if The Gruffalo is on this list, but as it's a picture book, it may not be.
Mm. 10.5 million copies. I mean, that's still shitloads.
Because, yeah, I think that's the absolutely mad thing, is that we're talking about numbers that are so massive, they almost become meaningless.
Yeah.
Like, 120 million compared to 10 million.
Yeah, that's absurd. But, yeah, and I mean, Agatha Christie, I think that's quite random as well. I know she's one of the most famous authors in the world, but I wouldn't have necessarily been able to pinpoint which of her books would be, like, why is that one more popular than, like, Murder on the Orient Express or something like that?
Which I would think was the more famous of the two.
100%.
And then I guess maybe it comes down to things like, is there, and then there were none, was it truly like the first of its kind? Like, have there been more movies based on it? Can these other factors influence to this scale?
Yeah, to this enormous scale.
Because we're literally talking the next bestseller. So those were all exceeding 100 million copies for individual books, not for series. The next figure that we have is The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is 85 million.
That's still a lot.
So that's still a huge number. That's quite a big jump, no?
Do you control F Agatha Christie? Because I want to know what the next...
That's the only Agatha Christie book on this page.
This is weird.
And just to give you an idea of the scale, these are all books that start with... let's see. Exceeding 10 million copies is like, that's the lowest bar.
So there's nothing between 10 million copies and 100 million copies for Agatha Christie.
The math isn't mathing, as we say online. I can't get my head around that.
This is wild. Okay, well, look, I'm mind-boggled already. Let's continue.
Okay, so then we hit the 50 million to 100 million list. And by the way, if you're wondering what list we're looking at, the most reliable list I could find was on Wikipedia. So obviously this is all with a massive pinch of salt. It's all going to be guesstimation. But the first adult book on this list is this one.
What?
Which I have never heard of. It's called She, A History of Adventure.
By the English writer H. Rider Haggard.
Who the fuck is that?
I have no idea. It says they're a contemporary of like Robert Louis Stevenson. So it's like an adventure, a colonial adventure, is it? I've literally never heard of this before.
These things are just so surprising. So that has come in at 83 million. So this book, She, A History of Adventure, has sold more copies than Game of Thrones.
Any of the Harry Potter books.
Any of the Harry Potter books. It's outsold everything apart from the 6 books we've already mentioned.
This is wild.
So then we have Pinocchio, which again is not necessarily the like children's fantasy that I would put...
I'm going to be honest.
So high on the list.
I didn't know Pinocchio was like owned by a specific person.
Did you think it was like a fairy tale?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
The thing is, I think
obviously fairy tales are also owned by specific people, like Hans Christian Andersen.
I guess I meant like a folk tale or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know what I thought. But I would never have thought that it was a straight adaptation of a book that was written in... you know, the last 150 years.
Yeah, 1881, if you're wondering.
Hmm.
Then we have the Da Vinci Code.
Which we will be coming back to.
Which we will come back to in a second. Then we have all the Harry Potters, which on average sell 65 million a piece.
So all the other Harry Potters, except for the first one.
120 million for the first book, 77 million for the second. And then after that, they all average out at about 65 million. Which is also equals to The Alchemist and The Catcher in the Rye. Have you read either of those books? I feel like they're the ones that you're most likely to have read.
Yeah, I've read Catcher in the Rye many years ago. Haven't read The Alchemist. But
what do you think of Catcher in the Rye?
Yeah, I quite liked it. I'd be interested to revisit it as an adult.
How old were you when you read it?
I don't know, but a young teenager, stupid. I would assume. Yeah, dumb. Yeah. Dumb as hell.
I think I read it when I was in my early 20s, and I really liked it. I think The Catcher in the Rye is a funny book because I think a lot of people don't realise that it's always been divisive.
Mm.
So you'll always see people showing off thinking that they're like going against the grain by saying that they loved it. But also you see people thinking that they're going against the grain by saying that they hated it. And it's like, that's the It'd Catcher like in the that. Rye. That's, yeah. The Alchemist I have read. I was on a flight home from a trip to Morocco with my pal, and I had only brought two books with me, both of which I'd finished, and I could not do. My friend was just sleeping, so I read the only book she had brought with her, which was The Alchemist.
Was it good?
I mean, obviously, yes. Like, it's a very satisfying fable-esque story about, like, you sometimes the things that you need and want the most are right under your nose. That's the, like, it's
the crux.
Yeah, like, it's an adult fable.
Mm.
The fact that it sold 65 million copies, I think, is unsurprising for me as a bookseller, because I have sold, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of copies a week. Even in the shop that I worked at that sold the least fiction, which was Waterstones Ilford, which mostly specialised in children's education, we still sold a shit ton of it. But weirdly, it's shelved in the mind, body and spirit section. It doesn't get shelved in general fiction.
That is so interesting. Isn't that weird?
Yeah. And also, I love this anecdote about The Alchemist. My husband once had a customer that was like, I'm looking for a book that's about a journey, but it's like an emotional journey as well as a physical one.
Eat, Pray, Love.
Yeah. Alex was like, well, that's literally every novel, yeah. But I'm guessing you're probably talking about The Alchemist. Okay. So then we have another one that I don't know. The Bridges of Madison County.
Well, that was a very famous film, and that's the only reason I've heard of it. I did not know. It's a romance about old people.
Okay.
As far as I know. And I did not know that was a book. And likewise, the next one, Ben-Hur, very famous film, didn't know that that was a book.
50 million copies sold, published in 1880.
Yep, had no idea that was a book.
And then the next one is one that I think is the biggest pile of garbage that you'll ever come across. It's called You Can Heal Your Life by Louise Hay. It's listed here as self-improvement. It's actually mind, body and spirit. It's a self-help book which says that your ailments and illnesses are caused by your own attitudes and behaviours. And there's loads of really, really hurtful and offensive things in there. And I don't think that it's a book that we should continue to sell in mainstream bookshops. As one example, it does say that AIDS is a reflection of sexual guilt. So fuck you, Louise Hay.
What a bitch.
50 million copies sold, though, so that's good. Which is also why, side note, mind, body and spirit sections in bookshops.
That's fucking dark. Like, there's a lot of dark shit happening
just
there.
Because something sells well, maybe we should question what value it brings
to our mind, body and spirit.
And whether it should be next to the health and medical sections, which is so often it's. Anyway, next on the list is 100 Years of Solitude.
Which I loved.
I haven't read it.
It's so good. It's another, you know, we talked about Piranesi in the last episode.
Yes.
It's one of those books that I just feel like, on paper, not for me. And then you read it and you're like, well, this is just so good, I simply cannot resist it.
Maybe I should read it.
It's so good. It's true magique in the form. You know, you read it and you're like, I'm just experiencing true pleasure, true joy.
So do you think, is it joyful? Or is it quite dark?
It's not joyful. I mean, it has dark, but it has a lot of light as well.
It's actually written much earlier than I thought.
Yeah.
It's from the 60s. I thought it was more like the 80s.
No. Yeah, he in the past.
You know that, I remember my dad once said about the photographer Man Ray, who I love very dearly. I have one of his photographs on my living room wall. That sometimes really iconic things actually come from much earlier than you might think.
Yeah.
Because that's why they are iconic.
So true.
Speaking of which, like the novel Lolita, which is next on the list, which is 1955. And I feel like that's also at 50 million copies sold worldwide.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me so much.
But yeah, that is, I mean, same with 100 Years of Solitude. Like, these are the kinds of books, if I had to make a guess, Catch in the Rye. Like, these ones don't surprise me.
They're what we would think of as, like, a modern classic.
Exactly.
A 20th century classic.
Exactly. And then, yeah, I'd love to
revisit Lolita, actually.
Cause we should do an episode on Lolita.
Yeah, I just feel like after I listened to that fascinating podcast, the Lolita podcast, I would like to recommend it again. Yeah, after I listened to that, I was like, I would really like to revisit it. But that podcast is so detailed that once you've listened to it, you don't necessarily feel motivated to read the book because it has just, you've experienced so much of it through that podcast. So I will, now that I've had a little cooling off period, I'm happy to dive right in.
That makes me feel like I need to reread Lolita then before I listen to the pod.
Yes, I would say so. Yeah.
And then we have like a little thatch of children's books. We have Heidi, Anne of Green Gables and Black Beauty, none of which I have read. Because I didn't read many children's classics as a child.
I think I might have read Black Beauty, or they're the kind of things that I might have had on like audio tape or something that I would make my grandparents listen to in the car or something, you know, like that kind of thing.
I was more of like a Roald Dahl.
Yeah, child. Yeah, yeah. And we had that on the audiobooks. But yeah, there were just a couple of things that I might not have read, but I might have had in some other format. I can't really remember.
So we're still cruising around the 50 million mark. But I feel like I'm surprised Peter Pan isn't higher.
Mm. Like, is he here?
He's not on this list. He's certainly not on the 50 million plus list. Peter Pan, though, which I did feel compelled to read a couple of years ago and found it very sexist. So there you go. There's also this one, The Common Sense Book of Baby and Childcare by Benjamin Spock.
Yeah, I've heard of this.
So this was on. The Guardian did this great feature last week, which was five writers giving, like, summing up their generation in three or four books.
Mm.
And the boomer author, and I forget who did the list, but he included this one. And I thought it seemed quite random, but
clearly it's a thing.
Yeah.
I haven't read The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco, but I could definitely be tempted. Possibly, I was thinking about it actually as we were reading The Da Vinci Code, as we will come on to imminently. Yeah, and I haven't read The Eagle Has Landed by Jack Higgins. Don't feel like I really know what that is. Don't really want to know. Watership Down by Richard Adams. Too dark for me. Don't want to read about that.
Too dark
for you. Way too dark.
Too dark for you.
Yeah.
Oh, my dad used to read, there's a little section in this book where a magpie gets tangled up in some barbed wire, something like that, and he tells all the rabbits to piss off. My dad used to do a great impression of the magpie.
I love this. Even that sounds dark.
Yeah, I mean, it's dark. It's a dark book.
Too dark. What the hell is The Height Report?
I don't know, but I like that it's called The Height Report by Sheer Height.
And it's in the category of sexology.
You know what? This is such an educational adventure. Sex educator and feminist. The myth of the vaginal orgasm is something that she responded to. Okay, fine. Okay, well, interesting. Never heard of that either. Okay, and then we have more kids' books. We have Charlotte's Web and The Ginger Man.
What's
the
that?
Ginger Man? No, I assumed it was The Gingerbread Man, but it's not. The Ginger Man is J.P. Donlevy.
It was banned by reason of obscenity? Well, fascinating. Another thing we haven't heard of. Maybe because we are dumb. But
that's still 50 million, but I'm surprised. Again, like, so we've now hit the 50 million mark. There are so many titles I'm surprised not to have seen.
Mm.
And I can only assume that for a lot of classics, it's an issue with tracking versions.
Yeah, like I am shocked that some of that stuff appears before, for example, Peter Pan. So,
or Dickens. There's no Brontes on there. Like, I'm assuming that there's an issue with tracking editions. So now we're on the 30 million to 50 million section, which is still like
absurd numbers.
An absurd number. Like, I mean, just to give you some insight into like book sales, to make it into the UK top 10 chart, the first maybe four entries, number one to four, one to five-ish, will usually be really high numbers. And these are weekly sales, obviously. But I was checking this week's top 10, and the number 10 in the chart at the minute has only sold 1,000 and something copies this week.
Mm.
I say only, that's still a huge number, but like the disparity between the top scale and then the bottom end of the top is completely wild. Okay, so
we won't go through all of these.
Yeah, we don't need to go through all of them. I think that's basically, that like it gives you the vibe though. There's just some really unexpected titles.
The other thing I was going to take us to, though, is I'm going to skip through all of the other single titles to the sets, the book series. Okay, so, oh, fuck, I meant to hide this from you, but you would have seen it now. Did you see who the second one is?
I did, unfortunately.
Okay. God damn it. Oh, well, so the best-selling book series of all time is obviously Harry Potter with 500 million copies. The second best-selling series of all time to date, with 350 million copies of all 62 plus books and also spin-off series. This has blown my mind. I tried to get my husband to guess, and he couldn't get it. It's Goosebumps.
That is so odd.
Like, what the fuck? Do they still even sell them?
Well, clearly. I mean, I would, if they sell that well, I'd be shocked if they didn't.
Yeah.
And like, what would have changed between like when we were young people and now? Like,
look, I was a bookseller for 7 years. We didn't stop. Oh,
interesting.
Yeah, like they were not. I thought
you were more thinking of like
you. No. Yeah. Like, they were not for sale when I was bookselling.
Huh. Maybe it's an American thing. I don't know.
It must be.
Well.
Or maybe they've re-released. I don't know. But then anyway, yeah. So then just looking, and it's interesting for book series, the first, aside from Perry Mason, which I think are adventure books.
They're like crime.
Or crime books, sorry, yeah. They are all children's book series.
Yeah.
And then amazingly, like, 50 Shades is quite far down the list, and yet it still sold 150 million copies.
Wild.
And then of that 150 million, I'm assuming that the lion's share is going to be book one.
Yeah.
But then 50 Shades, I think, when we're talking about these, like, we're talking about these bestsellers, some of these books are on here because of longevity, right? And then some of them, like 50 Shades, they were just, it's almost like they went viral.
Yeah.
They, you know, like,
there was a brief burning period.
Yeah.
But it burnt hard.
She burnt hard and fast.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a fun time in the bookshops. I've always said that, like, they came out in 2011, right when ebook sales were kind of on the brink of taking over physical book sales, or like, it was very touch and go. Kindles were kind of still very new, and bookshops were really struggling, and 50 Shades, like, you can slag them off all you want, but they really kept the shops afloat that summer. They brought so many people into the bookshops, they brought so many people into libraries. I always feel like it's worth hat tipping that, you know?
Yeah, 100%.
Okay, so enough flirting around looking at the best-selling books of all time. Should we get on to the matter at hand?
The matter at hand. That is the sound of Alice slamming down the Da Vinci Code.
It's just so big.
I didn't know it was so big. I've got to be honest. So I did this on audio. Alice tried to read it as a physical book. I didn't realize it was, how long is it? 600 pages?
It's 600 pages. I will say that the pages are quite small. Like, compared to, I mean, this is,
that's maybe a bad example, okay. But let's find another normal sized book.
So I've got First Love by Gwendoline Riley. So you can see a side by side page comparison. The average number of words on a page from First Love is like about 16, and here it's
16 lines.
10. 16 words per line. Which is about average.
Yeah.
Whereas this is more like 10. So, like, I don't think a modern print of this book is probably not going to be this like short, stocky little bitch. They'll probably put more words per page, so it'll be a bit thinner.
Do you think that was a tactical thing?
I don't know. I mean, I would be very interested to know if like the standard size of a paperback has changed. I'm not that knowledgeable about like the production side of things, so I can't remember what. I think this is called a C format, whereas the average paperback is a B format, I think.
Okay. I'm just very interested about why that would be.
But like, I have other books from the 90s that are like this. Like, my Interview with the Vampire is this size.
So it could just be that the whole thing has changed.
Yeah, that's, I think, fine. It's just trends have changed. But regardless, it still feels like a big fucking book.
Yeah.
And I really intended to read it. I didn't mean to flake out, but
I wonder if I would have flaked out if I wasn't doing it on audio. I did it on audio, and I had a gay old time.
Yeah, you were having a great time with it, weren't you?
I was having so much fun. I was listening to it on audio. Around the same time, I was reading one of the most hyped books of the year. And I'll tell you what I enjoyed more. It was listening to the Da Vinci Code. That is what I was having more fun doing. So on audio, it's just,
a fun little ride. It's just a silly, fun adventure book. It feels like, you know, a kind of contemporary Indiana Jones with a murder at the beginning. I don't know.
I mean, I feel like that's quite a good summary. Because I expected more murder.
So you thought it was more of a trad thriller?
Not what did you think? Thriller. Okay, so I'd never seen the movie. I haven't read the book.
We were both going in as virgins.
Yes, as virgin. But obviously I've sold enough copies of it. I've talked to enough people about it. I knew what I was getting myself into. So I knew it opened with a murder that needs to be solved, that presented a clue to something else. And that then Tom Hanks and Amelie then go around Paris solving these clues. And the impression I got was like the end of each chapter is a big cliffhanger.
Mm.
Or they solve another clue. And just as they solve something, they discover that it's actually only pointing to the next thing.
Yeah.
So I knew it was more of like an adventure thing. I just thought like the murder would be... I just thought it'd be a bit more murdery.
The thing that you were solving was the murder.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, yeah.
Whereas you're not solving the murder.
Because you know from page one, essentially, yes. Who killed this man.
Okay, so let me just talk about the murder. Can we talk about the murder? Let's talk about the murder. So I assume most people listening to this pod will be vaguely familiar with the Da Vinci Code. But just to summarize what happens, there is a murder in the Louvre. Yep. In Paris. The man, he's the curator.
He is a curator at the Louvre. Esteemed, older, experienced curator called Jacques Saunier.
Your memory is just... I love it. So he gets shot in the stomach. And the way that the security system works is that as soon as the alarm is triggered, rather than try and prevent crime, they simply try and trap criminals.
Whoever is doing the crime.
So, like... The galleries are all ceiling, right? That does mean that for security, it will take them like 15 minutes to reach the place in which there was a breach. So this man knows that he will be dead within 15 minutes. He's not going to survive to
be liberated. Yeah.
So what he chooses to do is set up an elaborate crime scene, which will serve several purposes. The first thing is he puts a clue in there, and this isn't a spoiler because it happens very quickly. He puts a clue to ensure that his granddaughter, who is a...
Cryptologist. At the Paris police, so she works on code breaking for the Paris police.
Yeah, so he puts a fake code in there to ensure that she is called to the crime scene.
Yeah.
To the average person's naked eyes, like, there's nothing else... Well, there's lots of other weird things, but, like... He includes another clue that's specifically for her that she will understand, but perhaps the police will not. My first question, right?
Oh, he also specifically... So I can't remember, did he write it in blood or in something else, but something about summoning Tom Hanks?
Yes, I put a post-it with the word lol. There we go. So he puts 13-3-221-1185, O draconian devil, O lame saint... P.S. Find Robert Langdon. I thought it was so fucking funny that he put P.S. But that is...
Dubs.
So the police call Robert Langdon, a.k.a. Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
But the P.S. is not just postscript. That's a link to her.
That is a link to Amelie.
That's a note for Amelie. But I thought it was so fucking funny to take the time to write P.S. The other thing that's very key about this crime scene... is that he has arranged his body in the shape of... I always forget what it's called. That Da Vinci...
The Vitruvian Man.
Vitruvian Man. Here's my fucking question, though, right? So this is an elderly man. He's arranging himself...
How many limbs has he got?
Well, first of all, how many limbs has he got? But he's arranging himself in this position of a famous artwork that he knows his granddaughter will recognise. Was it absolutely essential that he removed all his clothing to do this? Like, was that really intrinsic to the fucking painting? That he is bollock naked? Like, was it absolutely critical? I don't know. So that whole thing kind of, it tickled me.
It does, yeah. There's just a lot of, it's a silly book.
And then I think the other problem that I had with it is that I was, like, under the impression that the kind of treasure hunt of... Like, the scavenger hunt of clues would propel me through. But unfortunately, do you have certain things that just, like, make your brain just switch off?
Yeah, loads of things.
Yeah, like, if someone says Bitcoin, you're like, okay, I'm out. Yeah. So I start making a list of things in this book that I called it my turn-offs list. So these are all things that when they come up, I just...
Your burn feel killer.
Like I black out for about 5 seconds each time. Monks.
You hate monks?
Not into it. The word brotherhood.
Interesting.
Not into it. The phrase Knights Templar.
Okay, yeah. Hate it.
Yeet me off a cliff. The word cipher, except if we're talking about the independent queer press, who I really like. Otherwise, cipher. Every time I saw the word cipher, I felt like...
I want to die.
Yeah, something was happening in my brain. Something was not connecting. Then anything to do with numbers or mathematics, like the Fibonacci code, I was like, fuck me, I'm out. Also, I realised, as the book went on, anything to do with Da Vinci, I was just like...
So you've listed literally every single...
The last one is the word Holy Grail.
So everything, every single element of the Da Vinci code are things you specifically do not like.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're never going to finish this book.
I'm clearly not. And, like, I really got stuck. I feel like I got really stuck on, like, chapter 38. I think I read this line maybe 6 times. Every time I was like, Da Vinci, crack on with it. You can do this. 150 million people can't be wrong. Or however many copies it was. Sophie scrutinized Langdon in the back of the taxi. He's joking. The Holy Grail. Every time I read the words Holy Grail, I was just blacking out.
I'm done. I'm out. Which is a real problem if you're reading the Da Vinci Code. Because it is largely about the Holy Grail.
But do you think, was it like tapping into, was there a particular interest in like the Holy Grail, secret societies? Like, it's very kind of like Freemason-esque, like.
Yeah, definitely. You know, yeah.
Was there a particular interest for these things in the 90s?
Okay, I don't know. I wasn't there. Don't remember. But I just think what will have got people into this book is something that I think we are seeing in huge swathes now is like conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
That's what this book is. This book is like a kind of soft way into conspiracy theories. So I think that will be what triggered people's interest in this book. This will be why so many people read it and told people about it, because it's like being told secrets that they want to keep from you.
But you'd think, like, I fucking love secrets.
Yes,
I love them. And I also love celebrity-based conspiracy theories, like Louis Tomlinson's fake baby, for example.
Avril Lavigne is dead.
May she rest in peace. But I think there's just something about, like, the kind of Illuminati-esque, like, secret societies, brotherhoods of whatever, that I just find...
Slides off your brain.
Just so uninteresting.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, there was enough in the substance of this that I found kind of interesting. You know, things about, like, the construction of Christianity and the... kind of battle between paganism and Christianity, things that, you know, the Catholic Church did to assert its supremacy over paganism, to kind of demonize paganism, blah blah blah, all of that stuff, extreme sexism, how that has essentially, that's essentially a religious construct, all of that. Kind of interesting. Fine. But yeah, in general, I don't know how interesting this conspiracy theory is. But then, I do think that that is why it kind of titillated so many people.
So then I have another question.
Yes.
Is the Da Vinci specific conspiracy theories, of which many are mentioned in the book, things like hidden meaning in his work, bits of paintings that were covered up, hidden symbols, that kind of thing. Are these real conspiracy theories that people subscribe to, are interested in, follow, or do you think Dan Brown made them up?
I think probably a bit of both. The only thing that I actually Googled while I was listening was the picture. Did you get to the bit about the Last Supper?
Yes.
Yeah. So I just wanted to see what the Last Supper looks like, the painting. Which is true. Like, everything they say in the book about that painting is true. Which is very interesting. But yeah, I don't know. I have no idea. And I've never heard about this in any context other than this book. Do you know what I mean? I've never heard, like, it being dealt with in other media. I've never heard of that being... I've never heard of, like, Leonardo da Vinci being talked about in this way in any context other than this book. Potentially because it's now impossible to do it without the shadow of the Da Vinci Code over your noggin. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
It's pronounced Da Vinci, but...
Actually, it's Da Vinci, yeah.
I know, I mean, because something like, I'm curious about that. I think it's interesting. I mean... Like, they're talking about placement of the disciples in the Last Supper being a kind of code. They're talking about the topography in the background of the Madonna of the Rocks. Mm. And they're talking about the Mona Lisa having, like, a lapis lazuli pendant of Isis, which Da Vinci then painted over. So, like, if this is real, then I certainly admire putting together... A whole plot based around...
Yeah.
You'd have to be, like, a bit of a conspiracy nut to begin with. So, Dan Brown, are you a conspiracy nut?
I'm sure he'll get back to us.
Okay, I'm just going to quickly Google. Mona Lisa pendant. Lapis lazuli.
Look, it's only...
It's people selling them.
Yeah, but it's also only appearing in the context of the Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? So it is possible that he has made some of this stuff up. I don't know.
The other thing that I really enjoyed, isn't this just the most, like, I keep saying 90s. It was 90s, wasn't it? No, 2003.
Oh.
But isn't this just the most of its era line? So, da-da-da-da-da. This is actually talking about the lapis lazuli pendant. Langdon had never seen any evidence of the pendant, nor could he imagine how it could possibly reveal the Holy Grail. And yet, Grail aficionados still discussed it ad nauseum on internet bulletin boards and World Wide Web chat rooms.
Yes, I remember that line from my audio. Yeah,
I
remember
that.
It well.
So yeah, I guess something... So one thing that is true, like, I got to like page 236, so it's actually not even halfway. I think I managed to smash through like a third of it. I did actually read it relatively quickly. I think the point for me in which I switched off was when I realized that it was about the Holy Grail and that it's essentially like Christian slash Da Vinci fan fiction.
Mm.
And that suddenly I was like, I'm not gonna be excited to get to the end of this. And maybe I've done myself a disservice. So what I will say is I will watch the movie.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm happy I listened to it. I had a fun time making my earrings, listening to my Da Vinci Code on audiobook. But yeah, I have no real curiosity beyond that.
Oh, wait, how many hours is the audiobook?
Like, not an extraordinary amount. Yeah, so the audiobook is about 16 hours long.
Okay, yeah.
So it's long, but it's not...
It's not 600 pages long.
No.
This is just a bogus edition.
Yeah.
Slowing it down one last time.
Something I also thought was quite kind of funny about the book, and maybe it's more apparent in the when you listen to it on audio, because it's read by a man, but obviously it's read by a sort of American man, but so much of the book is French people, so he has to do loads of French accents. Sophie is in it quite a lot, Emily, and he has to do a kind of high-pitched French lady voice, which is horrible. It's so bad.
It's like, does he have to, though?
I guess so. Yeah,
I
guess
have to.
I feel like probably yes, and it's terrible and it's really grating, but it just makes you realize, maybe even more than you would if you read it on paper, it makes you realize the extent to which Sophie almost exists as so many scenes are Robert Langdon, Tom Hanks, explaining something to Sophie and therefore explaining something to the reader. Like, it's, I'd say 40% or 50% of the substance of the book is just someone explaining something that you didn't know from, like, history or, like, you know, the Bible or whatever. Like, it's just loads of explanation of these kind of conspiracy theories or, like, areas of research. And, yeah, I just think that's quite a kind of strange thing for a book to be almost, like, half action, you know, running from one place to another, escaping the police or whatever. But then the rest of it, it's just people standing around telling each other stuff from the Bible or the from Da Vinci. You know, like, it's quite, it's a strange thing.
But, like, it's an odd dynamic. But I think, I do think that maybe that is part of the, like, ingredients list that you need for a book to hit these kinds of sales, is that it's simultaneously incredibly easy to follow, incredibly compelling, because each chapter is super short and it usually ends on some kind of cliffhanger. Albeit a somewhat kind of, do I want to say cheap? Maybe I mean cheap, like a cheap cliffhanger. Like an obvious, how will they get out of this one kind of vibe. But then also it actually has the air of something that's quite smart.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think it's that. I think it's easy to read and it makes you feel smart because you are learning something that they don't want you to know, you know?
But also, like, even beyond that, I'm thinking about The Alchemist specifically, is that because it's written in this very, very accessible voice, it's incredibly easy to read, and then it's imparting some kind of pseudo-wisdom. That wisdom being sometimes the thing that you're looking for is
under your schnoz.
Right under your little nose. Oh my god, breaking news. It won't be breaking news by the time this episode airs. The woman with the sign that caused the mass crash at the Tour de France, she's been fucking caught. She's been on the run.
Oh my god. Well, good luck to her. So, the thing I wanted to look up while Jenny was sending through this very shocking information. Did you know? You know the book Angels and Demons?
Yes.
What do you know about this book?
Nothing. I know it's also Robert Langdon, but that's it.
So what I find very interesting is Angels and Demons is not a sequel to The Da Vinci Code. It was published 3 years before The Da Vinci Code. Yep. Isn't that wild?
That is wild.
So that was already out there. There is a Robert Langdon cinematic universe.
Yeah.
And Angels and Demons was out there for 3 years before The Da Vinci Code.
So I think, okay, I do remember you telling me this because I responded saying it's a whole Silence of the Lambs, Red Dragon.
Oh, yes. Situation. We have seen each other, maybe, or something.
Oh, we spoke. I can't remember. Yeah. But that compels me to check. If there's more than one Langdon book, does that mean, as a series, they exist on our list of all-time bestsellers? Or is Da Vinci really pulling weight? Okay, so Da Vinci has sold 80 million.
Angels, there he is.
The Lost Symbol, 30 million. Robert Langdon series, 200 million. So 80 million copies of Da Vinci.
Of which there are million. Five. There's five in this series, apparently.
So there's five books in total. Wow. So almost half of them have just been on the one book.
Could you name one that isn't The Da Vinci Code or Angels and Demons?
Well, The Lost Symbol, but that's because I just saw it.
Yeah. So 30 seconds ago, could you have named?
No.
Me either.
Although I feel like I probably should be able to name.
But you were a bookseller when this was a thing. Maybe not when it was peak thing, but yeah, for something that sold that many copies, you'd think were people coming in and buying The Da Vinci Code in your day?
Yes.
Yeah. So there's no reason why they wouldn't have been buying the other ones too.
But I don't feel like... So that's the thing, okay? With a lot of the books we discussed in this episode, if you were building a table of adult perennial bestsellers or like contemporary classics, things like The Alchemist continues to sell well. Lolita continues to sell incredibly well. What was the other one I was just thinking of? Catcher in the Rye, yeah. Norwegian Wood, The Handmaid's Tale. Like, there, some of these books continue to remain relevant and in, like, the public eye, right? You would never... I just don't think you would put Dan Brown or 50 Shades of Grey. Some of them feel a little bit dated or have just sold in such, like, incredible volumes. Like, I do not understand why any, like, living, breathing human being can walk into a bookshop and pay full price for The Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
Like, I literally, it took me a while to get hold of a copy because the charity shops were shut, but I was like, I don't need to pay $7.99 for this. I can get a copy for 50p.
Yeah, because there it will be in every charity shop.
And in fact, Emily Hatzar, another shout out, aka Crafty Glass, our friend who makes stained glass, she found it for me in a charity shop for 99p and her dad cycled it around for me.
Oh.
Shout out to Paul.
Big up, Paul.
So yeah, like, I don't, some of them, and I mean, I suppose the same is obviously true with Catcher in the Rye, but I just think, like, or Lolita or whatever, but when you're talking about something that 80 million copies, approximately, the number is going to be way higher than that because of digital books, right? I just can't believe that they still sell.
Yeah, you're right. So shall we wrap up by contemplating what from the last few years we think are of this magnitude? Not necessarily in pure numbers, because they haven't existed for long enough to hit them yet, but just in terms of like those real outliers in terms of numbers. So the thing that I'm thinking of first and foremost is Where the Crawdads Sing.
Yeah.
Which just sells and sells and sells and sells and sells.
Yeah.
For some reason. Don't really know what it's about. Feel like it's about 10 different things. Every time I hear what it's about, I then hear...
Weirder?
Yeah, I know, but there's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
So that's one I would think of. So that's... Where the Crawdads Sing, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, I would put... Obviously, it's brand new, but the Thursday Murder Club has already sold 1 million copies.
In less than a year. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, I feel like...
Definitely.
That feels unlikely to me to be something which fizzles out, especially as he's already got his second one out. Yeah. Like, so yeah, the Thursday Murder Club.
Second one not quite out yet, out soon. Yeah.
I don't know why. I'm turning around looking at my books and it's a whole line of proofs of books that haven't come out yet.
Because obviously there's things that really pop off when they come out, something like Eleanor Oliphant, but that doesn't necessarily guarantee those prolonged enormous sales in the way of like Where the Crawdads Sing.
I mean,
Normal People?
I was thinking Normal People. I feel like Normal People will remain. Because that's the thing, that I feel like when I first read it, and I've only read it once. So, when I read it with this really early copy, and it immediately made me think of romances like The Time Traveler's Wife or One Day.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, those, like...
Timeless.
Very timeless. Yeah. So I feel like it will continue to sell in the same kind of, like, also, consistent...
Without the TV adaptation, it would have probably been a massive selling book for Faber, really successful. But with the TV, that's just propelled it to a level that is truly, you know, long term.
I'm now just trying to flip through to see like the most contemporary book on this list. And I think it's Girl on the Train from 2015. But then, you know, I think what's really hard with, like, these books that sell in this kind of volume, they don't necessarily, for a reader, they don't necessarily... Oh, here we go. Oh, okay, 2018, Becoming by Michelle Obama. So it's nonfiction.
Another one I would think of in the kind of YA children's space is The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas, which just
in the UK, for the first year of sales, it was not that great. I think it picked up eventually, but I remember thinking it was doing really well because we were selling lots of copies in the bookshop I was in, but I think it only sold something like 4,000 that year, which isn't high.
It's not high, but with American sales, and if you look at the New York Times bestseller list for children's,
it's still there,
it's never been out of the top 10 ever since it's been published for years.
Something else I just saw recently that's been in the top 20 for like a long time, like 18 months or something.
In America?
Yeah, I
can't. One of Us Is Lying by Karen McManus.
No, it wasn't a YA, it was a adult book.
Ah.
I can't remember, I'd have to Google it. But you know, the thing is, the problem is I feel like, oh, you know what? Some maybe slightly more obvious ones, but All the Light We Cannot See is one that's weirdly just never stopped selling. And Fourth Estate have just released a new cover of it, like a new edition in part of its like, a very odd mix of stuff, like a mix of fiction and non-fiction.
Oh, they, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Really beautifully designed covers. There's, like, the Virgin Suicides amongst them.
The eel one.
Yeah. Not eel, the octopus one.
Octopus, yeah.
Yeah, what a great question. I feel like I need to be in a bookshop. If we were, like, if we were on the road.
If we were doing a roving report.
Yeah, like, on location. Because that's what I started to say, is I feel like sometimes with books like this, like, when you're looking at sales of this magnitude, but your actual reading experience is not necessarily going to match, like, the reputation. And I know that seems really obvious, but I just think it's something that people forget, you know? That, like, these books aren't written to be bestsellers. Like, we don't really understand the alchemy that can happen that takes a book from an author's brain through a good marketing campaign, but lots of incredible books don't reach this level of like virality, and lots of the books that do don't necessarily deserve it.
Yeah.
So I think it can be really difficult to tell, like, I think 50 Shades was inevitable that it was going to, like, sink is the wrong word, because it's still like she's had three more books out since then and they have all sold incredibly well, but they are kind of famously not very well written. You know, like, we don't really know why they do as well as they do. And then there'll be some books like the 10 that we discussed last week, our top 10 books of the year so far, Will any of those end up like this?
No way, no way.
Absolutely not. No fucking way.
They probably won't even be the best-selling books of this year, realistically. Well, they won't, because of Thursday Murder Club. Yeah, I just think the thing that I really find fascinating is the fact that The Da Vinci Code was not even the first book in the series. What was it about that book, rather than Angels and Demons, rather than any of the books Dan Brown had written before that, what was it that was so perfectly calibrated to capture people's imaginations in the way that it did, on the magnitude that it did? Like, what was that? I'd love to know.
Also, do you know, I think of it as like a real dad book.
Yeah, total dad. Not my dad, but someone's dad.
My dad. I feel like my dad would have probably liked this shit. He liked maths.
Yeah.
You know, and conspiracies. Knights Templars. and conspiracies. But yeah, I wonder as well, like, out of all the books that we've discussed, which I'm not going to now try and pull this data, but I wonder what, like, the gender split is. Like, obviously, I feel like old JK really sways the... Yeah, a lot of men there.
Mm.
Anyway, food for thought.
Food for thought, make you think. So, yeah, if our friends at home have any thoughts that you'd like to add to our predicted future million, billion, billion sellers, let us know. What do you think is going to be on this list in a few years?
And also, are there any other books of this nature that you would like us to do an episode on? Did you enjoy this episode? It's not our normal thing. We're doing something a little bit different. Let us know if you'd like to see us discuss something else like this.
Of this ilk. Well, we'll see you next time.
Bye! Bye.